The Division of Elections updates the vote count in the tight race between Mark Begich and Ted Stevens for Alaska's U.S. Senate seat. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 14th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state's new employee retirement plan suffers along with the slumping stock market.
Members are very concerned about whether or not they will have anything at all in their retirement accounts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com.
The Division of Elections has posted the results of its count of absentee early and question ballots today, showing more than 17,000 more votes included in the tally. 24,000 more votes still need to be counted by the middle of next week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
In the two vote updates released today, Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich slightly increased his lead over incumbent U.S. Senator Ted Stevens. Begich now is ahead by 1,022 votes, with more than 300,000 ballots turned into the Division of Elections so far. He was ahead by 814 votes when the count finished on Wednesday. Congressman Don Young also increased his lead today over Democratic challenger Ethan Berkowitz. He's up by 16,701 votes. None of the leaders in legislative contests changed in today's count, although one race leaves both candidates heading for an uncertain weekend. Incumbent Republican House member Mike Kelly now has a one-vote lead over Democrat Carl Castle in their race for Fairbanks District 7. More vote results are expected next week. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The global financial crisis is bringing new attention to the state's recently changed retirement plan. New hires participating in the state's defined contribution plan say they're forced to put money into the system and are hurt by its recent losses. Funds managed by the Alaska Retirement Board are down about 17% since July. KTOO's Weld Royal has the story.
When Congress passed its monumental financial bailout package last month, Pat Shire and colleagues at the State Division of Retirement and Benefits started taking a lot of calls from retirees.
When the situation began to unfold, we had persons calling wondering if their retirement check was going to show up in the mail. And we were able to answer accordingly, depending on what their situation was, what kind of a retiree they were.
The answer to calls from public employees and teachers covered by the old defined benefit program was easy. Benefits are guaranteed by the Alaska Constitution and remain secure, unthreatened by market swings. But teachers, municipal or state workers hired since mid-2006 heard a different answer. Their account balance is not guaranteed. No investment options are risk-free. When the legislature replaced the defined benefit system with a defined contribution plan, they blamed the old system in part for the state's multi-billion dollar unfunded liability in teachers' and public employees' retirement funds, known as TERS and PERS. Ryan Marquis is covered by the new plan, which works like a 401k. He says he's expecting a quarterly statement on his retirement account any day now and dreads opening it.
When I retire from this system, it's, you know, whatever money is in my account, and you know, it could be a lot of money, and it could be no money at all. I mean, and I definitely have potential to outlive it.
Marquis is a member of the Alaska Public Employees Association. APEA legislative liaison Cindy Spanier says members started complaining about the new retirement system long before the financial crisis, but its onset has brought fresh calls and more of them.
Members are very concerned about whether or not they will have anything at all in their retirement accounts. They are real concerned about the investment fees that always seem to stay the same regardless as to whether or not the market goes up or down. Oh, gosh, gee, we've been talking here. I just got a New York Times alert. Dow falls 400 points.
Spanier says bringing back the old retirement system is the union's top legislative priority. In March, the Department of Administration issued results of a study on how the new system hurts or helps recruitment and retention. It indicates that managers reported difficulties in recruiting due to uncompetitive wages, not the retirement plan. There is also a concern that employees covered by the new plan will leave after they are employed long enough to receive maximum benefits, for many after 5 years. The report concluded it's too soon to tell. Gary Bader is Chief Investment Officer of the state's Treasury Division and oversees public employee retirement accounts. He says in September, as the world's financial difficulties worsened, the Alaska Retirement Board introduced 7 new investment options for employees enrolled in the defined contribution system. Bader says the options had been in the works for a while, but as the market conditions deteriorated, the board called for a special meeting to approve them.
We worked as hard as we could to get them available to employees as soon as possible. And I think they were there for those who were wanting to find a wider array of places to invest their money.
New investment options aren't enough for Juneau Democratic Senator Kim Elton. He plans to introduce a bill in the upcoming legislative session to bring back the guaranteed pension plan. He says employers are calling for it.
Many of the calls and the concerns that have been expressed to our office are not from state employees looking for a job. They are from those people whose task it is to recruit and retain people. It has been especially challenging, and we're hearing a lot from school districts. It comes down to we now have one of the riskier retirement plans for public employees.
A similar bill backed by Elton was introduced last year but died in committee. In Juneau, I'm Weld Royal.
World oil prices have fallen dramatically since their summertime highs of more than $140 a barrel. In southeast Alaska, prices for heating oil and gasoline have declined much more slowly. In some communities, prices have actually increased since this summer. Angoon, Gustavus, Cake, Pelican, Point Baker, and Thorne Bay all report gasoline prices increasing from June to mid-October. In all those communities except Gustavus and Thorne Bay, heating oil prices also increased. The state State's Division of Community and Regional Affairs surveyed fuel prices across Alaska last month. Southeast Alaska Native leaders meeting this week in Juneau say energy costs are crippling their communities. The state's Power Cost Equalization Program subsidizes electricity in many villages that rely on diesel generators. But Representative Bill Thomas of Haines says the subsidy isn't offered to businesses, schools, or organizations.
Businesses don't get PCE. They're paying the top 63 cents for electricity. Well, anybody knows that they're paying for it, but if you're buying a loaf of bread, a gallon of milk, you're paying for that darn thing.
The state of Alaska has poured more money into programs to help homeowners lower their heating bills, but those programs are struggling to keep up with demand in a year of record-breaking energy costs. Sherry Simmons is with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. She told the Southeast Alaska Native Summit yesterday that more than 10,000 people statewide are on waiting lists for rebates on the cost of making their homes more energy efficient. Simmons says the bottleneck is getting a home energy rating to qualify for a rebate.
The raters were overwhelmed. They couldn't get to the phone calls and do their ratings, and people were getting very frustrated.
The state is training more energy raters, but Simmons says there's even a waiting list to get into those classes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an important cultural leader in Alaska hits the century mark.
To see it, people living a life of integration. That's big.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered. APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
A foster care summit was held today at the Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage. Lawmakers, along with state, tribal, and federal child advocates, grappled with the high rates of caseworker turnover, burnout, and shortages. John Henderson with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Children's Bureau said foster care families aren't getting the assistance they need to provide for their children.
So only in one-third of the cases are the services, are needs being appropriately assessed and services being provided? How can you move a case forward when you have that kind of constellation?
Henderson said the state also needs to get better at involving children and parents in their case plan. But he said the biggest issue in Alaska was not meeting the standard of visiting both the children and families in their homes once each month. Henderson says that's happening 26% of the time for children and 20% of the time for parents.
Now, let me qualify that a little bit. I don't want you to think that you got 1 month where you've got a visit, the next month you don't have a visit, the next month you do have a visit. What we're seeing in cases that have 6, 8, 9, 10 months that children and families are not being seen by the workers and they are in your custody or under your supervision.
Henderson said Alaska is only meeting the goal of establishing stability for the child within 60 days, either through a plan of reunification, guardianship, or placement with relatives about a third of the time. Anchorage Senator Fred Dyson says he's been to parenting classes where the parents who need them aren't the ones who are there.
Most of these resources and training are available in the community, but the people who need it either don't recognize it or won't get off their butt and go get it. And are you implying that we, the state, are supposed to go into that home, tell them that they need that, and then bring that training into their home?
Sometimes I would say yes, that providing services directly into that home is a useful and helpful tool for families.
However, Henderson said he disagreed that there were adequate levels of services currently available to families. Office of Children's Services Director Tammy Sandoval said, from her perspective, the most important work starts with home visits.
You can't write a court report. You can't, I mean, all the things that are a part of the tick list that workers have to do has to come from information collected as a result of meeting with a family. A child, don't know about child safety unless you're meeting with the child. You don't know how to help put families back together or keep them together unless you've met with the family. But all of that emphasis hasn't resulted in the kind of outcomes that we need.
Sandoval also said that she believes working on in-home services is critical in Alaska.
I believe that there are too many kids in out-of-home care. I believe that we could be serving families successfully with kids in their own homes. But I think that we get reactionary because it's scary to leave kids in their own home. And so I think that we remove and then try to return, and in partnership with the feds and the resource centers and our tribal partners, we're working on doing that better.
Sandoval said in the last 5 years, OCS has received funding for 77 new positions, mostly in the frontline services. She said vacancy rates have improved from 13% to around 9%. James LaBelle with Cook Inlet Tribal Corporation said, although Alaska Natives make up around 19% of the state's population, they represent more than 65% of the out-of-home placements.
And then you look at specific regions such as in Juneau, the native population is just over 16%, but whereas the children out of home placement are over 73%.
LaBelle said native kids are 6.5 times more likely to be in foster care than white kids. He said part of the problem is families moving to urban areas where they don't have access to extended family, community, and cultural resources to assist them in dealing with urban pressures. Native children also linger in state custody longer than white children. Tribal advocates say this is exacerbated by the turnover rate with OCS caseworkers, which breaks continuity of trust, understanding, and services. Hundreds of millions of dollars in state renewable energy funds has communities scrambling to come up with new projects. Jody Mitchell is with the Juneau-based Inside Passage Electric Co-op. The co-op provides diesel power to 5 native villages.
You know, it's really great that the state has got all this money out now for energy projects. However, what that's kind of done is brought all these snake oil salesmen out, and it's really taking a lot of time to make sure what we are told is actually the truth and making sure that we pick the best solution for the village.
Some Alaskans have been pursuing non-polluting energy long before state governments sped up the money train. KTOO's John Ryan brings us this profile of a Petersburg man who's working on a small scale to help local homeowners beat their addiction to oil.
Ben Johnson started out answering phones for the Petersburg Indian Association. Then he was an AmeriCorps volunteer there, and then he got hired to be director of operations. Under Johnson's youthful direction, the tribal association has been selling compressed blocks of wood waste. Customers heat their homes with the briquettes instead of burning expensive heating oil or labor-intensive firewood. As Johnson told the Southeast Alaska Native Summit on Wednesday, the main motivation for the project was economic.
The barge with all the heating oil comes in. I just feel like when it pulls out, it's filled with all of our money. And with this project, the money's just rotating in town.
Johnson also plugs the environmental benefits of stamping out burnable briquettes from wood scraps.
We're reusing waste wood on the island. The really cool thing, too, that I like about this project is burning wood is they count as carbon neutral, because even though you're releasing carbon into the atmosphere, a tree only releases as much carbon when it burns as it took in during its life. So as long as you keep growing more trees, it's just going to keep the circle going, or as opposed to burning, 10-billion-year-old dinosaurs and releasing carbon that hasn't been in the atmosphere for billions of years.
That's a little poetic license there, since the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old, and the first dinosaurs roamed the Earth around 200 million years ago. And oil is actually made of ancient plankton and plants, not dinosaurs. But his point is accurate. Biomass energy is climate-friendly, unlike fossil fuels. The Petersburg Briquette Project has had some advantages that most competing sources of energy don't.
The Petersburg School District is actually giving us kids on a work credit program. So they can come in, fill the machine, take the briquettes out, stack them, package them, things like that, deliver them. They get school credit and we get free labor, which is a big bonus. And then the city has let us use a lot of their facilities, including their chipper, which we accidentally stole from them, but then they let us keep, which was, it was really nice of them.
There's no shortage of raw materials in Petersburg to turn into briquettes. Johnson's taken leftovers from a U.S. Forest Service thinning project. He's gone to the town dump, and he's even taken pull tabs from the Moose Lodge.
We've taken this stuff from everywhere. Some guy tore out a bunch of bushes in his front yard. We ran those through the chipper and put them in the machine. Pretty much anything we can get our hands on, we run through there.
Johnson says the project got off to a rough start when they tried to turn some wet wood chips into briquettes.
So, of course, the first thing we did was took a bunch of wet wood chips we had, threw it in there, and there was so much water, and we found out water doesn't compress very well. So when it was going through the hydraulic press, the press broke. And that was, 10 minutes after turning this thing on. But we just called up the guy at the local machine shop, and he had it fixed in no time. It's just the same kind of stuff that they have on fishing boats and anywhere else, so it was really easy for him to work on.
The briquette maker is a very simple technology. Wood chips go in, and a hydraulic press smushes them into briquettes. That's it. Unfortunately, the big metal bin of a machine also resembles a dumpster.
We didn't look in it one day, and people threw a bunch of garbage into our briquette. We just went and turned it on, and there was diapers in there. And our maintenance guy was not too happy when we told him about this, but anything else, anything bio-based, works really, really well.
Johnson and his one coworker are making about a ton of briquettes a week right now. That's only enough to keep a half dozen homes warm. And Johnson says he has a huge waiting list of customers. He hopes to ramp up to about 10 times the current production, if only he can figure out a reliable way to get large volumes of wood chips dry. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
This week on AK Thrift, we share ideas on how to spend less during the economic downturn and talk to Alaska natives who are moving into cities to save money. This week on AK.
A representative from Greenpeace is on Kodiak Island to discuss his new initiative. George Pletnikoff, who grew up in the Pribilof Islands, is the Alaska Oceans campaigner for Greenpeace USA. He's speaking with tribal leaders in Kodiak today and will fly down to Old Harbor for meetings there over the weekend. The purpose of his visit is to lay the initial groundwork for what he calls marine cultural heritage zones.
What we would like to see from my visit over the weekend is to begin drawing lines on a chart and say that to our knowledge and our native ways of knowing, our traditional knowledge, our areas that are critical to the survival of the foods that we depend upon and therefore to the survival of our communities. And that these areas should either be off limits to bottom trawling, which would be, you know, of course, the preferred alternative, or to be severely limited in how those areas are used in the commercial fishing industry.
Though he's looking to natives for their traditional knowledge of the sea and its resources, Pletnikoff says he's not envisioning a native preference for use of the areas.
And one of the larger steps is going to be, how are we going to regulate this? Does the National Fishery Service have jurisdiction over that? And I assume that they do, as well as the state of Alaska, out to 3 miles and so on. So it's going to take a long time to negotiate what we hope will develop into co-management relationships with the tribes, National Fishery Service, and the state of Alaska's resource managers.
Pletnikoff says he got the idea for marine cultural heritage zones when an archaeologist told him just how much his ancestors 3,000 years ago depended on the ocean.
And then looking at the imbalance, I think, between a lot of our communities and the commercial fishing industry, that the commercial fishing industry is primarily a Seattle-based industry. And that the communities that live on the ocean, where we have the richest resources in the world, and we have so little benefit from it, and that all of those resources are being given out into ownership to somebody else, that our people in the villages are essentially left with nothing.
He says cultural heritage zones would be one way to help save marine resources from the dangers of climate change, allowing life in rural villages to remain sustainable. At 100, the Reverend Dr. Walter Sobolev is still active and revered as a Tlingit cultural leader and Presbyterian minister. He is known statewide for his preaching and teaching, his good nature, wit, and wonderful sense of humor. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has the story from Juneau.
The Reverend Dr. Walter Sobolev is a century old today. The Tlingit elder and Presbyterian minister has been preaching since he was 32 years old. He serves as pastor emeritus at Juneau's Northern Light United Church, officiates at weddings and memorials, and speaks to large gatherings and small, in and out of Alaska. Until 5 years ago, he was still driving. He's steady on his feet, though he now uses a cane. He's healthy. And as one parishioner and friend says,
he's as sharp as pencil in a box.
Over the years, I've had the opportunity to hear Dr. Sobolev in the pulpit, interview him, and help him celebrate his 98th and 99th birthdays. This morning, we bring you a few segments from some of those interviews and speeches as we wish him a happy 100th.
I was in the first grade, and the teacher said, take care of the old person you're going to become. And I thought, what a funny talk to give us. But I never forgot it. It was one of the best messages I ever heard. Take care of the old person you're going to become. Here I am. Here I am.
Walter Sobolev was born November 14, 1908, in Killisnoo on Admiralty Island. His grandfather was a Russian Orthodox priest. It was at Sheldon Jackson School in Sitka that he first heard sermons in English. He became a Presbyterian. He graduated from high school during the Great Depression, but was given a full scholarship to the University of Dubuque in Iowa. He was ordained in the Presbyterian Church in 1940 and assigned to Juneau's Memorial Presbyterian at 8th and Glacier Streets. The building is gone now, replaced by Juneau's downtown fire station. After 22 years, the congregation was folded into Northern Lights United Church, an amalgam of Methodists and Presbyterians and all races.
It started out as a church for the Tlingit people. It wasn't their choice, but they had to make it because they didn't feel welcome in other churches, so they wanted their own. Juneau had strong segregation attitudes, very strong. you could see signs on some of the public places that the natives were not welcome. I saw those signs. To see people living a life of integration, that's big. People accepting each other, people accepting other races, such as this church. This church means to me not Presbyterians getting together, nor Methodists getting together, but people getting together as Christians. And as soon as we forget denominations, we'll be so much better off because we are first Christians. I served on the mission boat from 62 to 70 on the Princeton Hall and on the Anna Jackman. It was a service ship. It helped where they saw there was need. We'd get in a storm, and in a wooden ship, you could feel the ship creaking. It would be bending in the seas. On the Anna Jackman, a steel hull, you never heard any creaking. That ship just didn't bend in a storm. It was solid. I remember stopping at the lighthouse stations at Five Finger Light. I'd go up to the dock with a pack sack on my back, Bibles, and I'd have visits with the Coast Guardsmen, four or five men, remote. Every boat going by never stopped. We did. And the fellas liked it. I visited with them and had short devotions. We went to Point Retreat the same way. And I gave a Bible to one fella and he said, "Now I have time to read the Bible." I gave him one, you know. "Now I have time to read the Bible." I'll never forget that. Such good visits. Such good visits.
Dr. Sobolev is still visiting and teaching. He is the cultural and Christian standard bearer for the Tlingit people. His advice to those who hope to be healthy and active to age 100?
Young people, you must take better care of yourself. The world needs your leadership. Your people need your leadership. Many of us who are a little bit older, we will be gone. And you will stand in a place where we have stood and where we have been serving. Can we depend on you? And when that call comes, say, "Here am I. Send me."
In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Weld Royal, John Ryan, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business, and by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.